Hello, hello. Welcome to the House Einstein podcast. This is podcast 32, and I am Osman Parvez with House Einstein. With me is Hamish Crabb and Ian Steinmo.
Hello, hello. I'm Hamish Crabb.
Good afternoon.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I've been with the brokerage for a little over 2 years now, and just help keep things running smoothly, supporting the agents on the team and taking care of marketing tasks. Ian, what's up with you?
I'm Ian Steinmo, one of the agents on the team. I'm a rare Boulder native, and I've been working in real estate for 4 years now, all of which has been with Osman, Sophie, Hamish, and the dream team, House Einstein. Actually, Osman and Sophie sold me my home in Martin Acres, Majestic Heights, 6 years ago, and we became good friends, and they give me opportunity to work in real estate alongside them. And it's been a very fun journey. And I really love this town, this area, and I love helping people make smart real estate decisions here.
Perfect fit, you could say.
And I'm Osman. I've been a broker for about 20 years, and I'm the founder of House Einstein, but I'm also a real estate agent here in Boulder. And our company covers everywhere from Denver to Fort Collins, into the mountain towns as well. And Ian, your background is so fascinating. We'll get to it when we start talking about what you recently experienced, one of our topics today. So let's walk through the topics. And before we do that, let me give a slight disclaimer. This podcast is entertainment, and that's for legal purposes. It's not real estate advice. It's not financial advice. Romantic advice, relationship advice, spiritual advice, none of those things. It's humor, unless you happen to be a client. If you are a client and you want actual advice, don't rely on the podcast. Please call us or email us, and we are here to serve you. But if you're not a client and you're considering becoming one, you can find us at houseeinstein.com. And this week, we're going to be talking about this really scary situation with a fraudulent seller, and we're going to lead with that, so we won't keep you waiting to the end of the podcast. And that is an experience that Ian had recently with a transaction. We're also going to be talking about fire mitigation. That's in our segment called Tell Me Something I Don't Know. There's a ton to learn about wildfire risk and how to mitigate it, and we've got some information about prescribed burns. We're going to talk about our sale of the week, which is a property in the Chautauqua neighborhood. And then we're going to touch on our listings that are coming and the buyers we're currently working with. And that should round out the hour or so for the House Einstein podcast.
That's right. Okie dokie. Well, Osman, you've got the tee-ups pretty much down pat. I'll let you take it away.
All right. Well, when I first heard this story from Ian about what happened with his transaction, I just was astounded. I had not heard of this level of scam behavior yet. And scams are quite common in real estate. The most common one is that someone tries to divert a wire during closing. They find out about the transaction and they try to steal a wire. This is so far beyond stealing a wire that I was just shocked. And I asked Ian if he'd consider joining us for the podcast, because not only is a terrific agent and he served his clients really well, but I think he should share this story himself. So, Ian, well, maybe before you jump in, I kind of feel like we should know more about you. Like your bio is so short, and you've got such an interesting history, and you offer such an amazing array of skills that very few real estate agents offer here in Colorado. Do you want to tell us a little bit, like, where you grew up here? What else have you done before real estate?
Well, thank you. First off, thanks for having me, Osman Hamish, and thank you to all of our listeners out there. So I grew up in Boulder. I moved here when I was three. My dad taught at CU for 35 plus years. So moved to Boulder at a young age. And I studied economics, politics, and Chinese in college, and ended up living in Shanghai for 5 years and Singapore for a couple of years, working for large, primarily publicly traded sports companies, parent companies of sports brands more often than not. And the role I played for these brands was to help them expand their global footprint. So I would work on the supply chain side and also the distribution sales side, work with partners in Japan, New Zealand, Brazil, places like that, helping these brands that are large enough for to economically make sense for them to expand internationally, but maybe not, you know, Nike 2 billion plus size where they have regional offices all over the place. So I would manage teams of distribution teams all over, basically. And it started with China and then kind of expanded to Asia Pacific. And then by the end, Osmond, when you sold me my house, I was managing 38 countries. So all of Asia Pacific, Oceania, as well as South and Central America, helping build brands and making sure that customs were cleared, product entered, and then doing the financial reporting for to the board of directors for these brands, which was very fun. I learned a lot. I enjoyed it immensely in my 20s. I loved the nice hotels. I loved working with international teams. There was a great deal that was fascinating and fulfilling about it, but I got pretty tired of constantly not being here. And, you know, I'd gone through great lengths and saved some money to live in Colorado, and I repatriated from Singapore, was based in Boulder, and I was still spending about 65% of my time on the road. So I was essentially returning from trips, you know, exhausted, jet lag, tired, etc., and then having to jump on calls with the board and explain when revenue was going to come in and what was going to happen with EBITDA and our finances and so on. And I really didn't have any time to enjoy being in Boulder and be part of a community. And I got to know Osmond and Sophie, and we became friends. And I actually don't even remember who initially began a conversation of maybe me going into real estate, but it was pretty organic and seamless. And I got my license, and I think that some of the financial skills I learned in my past career translate hopefully to helping people make smart decisions on the buy and the sell side. And I just really enjoy it. I enjoy working with people. I enjoy being part of a community. And I can just, the feeling of calling someone and telling them that they got the house in, you know, pick a neighborhood, really in throughout the state of Colorado, because it's just a competitive landscape. Making that call is more rewarding, and fulfilling than anything I ever did to make money for large publicly traded companies, you know. And I get to be here, which is really fun. So it's been a fun journey, and I'm really happy to be here, and I'm going to be around for a while.
Well, I just feel like your native understanding of our community, growing up here, going to the public schools, I've certainly learned quite a bit from our clients and our friends, but there's no way that is on the same footing as actually having gone to school here and grown up here. And now and your professional skill set that you brought to the table, we're so grateful for, and your nuanced cultural understanding and language skills always blow me away. And I want to brag a little bit just on how fluent you are.
Thank you.
In languages that I can't imagine speaking. So thank you for joining House Einstein. So what happened? Tell us the story of this transaction.
This is a weird one. This is both weird and scary, honestly. This could have been a serious debacle. So this is last month, December 2023. I have a really wonderful buyer who, like so many, sees all the appeals of living in Boulder County, but also wants to live in the mountains. And he wants to build a home from start in the mountains, Boulder area, basically in between Boulder and Nederland, pretty much. He's an out-of-state buyer too. And we've been searching for some time to find a lot that's both beautiful and buildable. And we found one, really nice lot, let's say close to the Boulder Canyon. Found this nice lot. I engaged with the listing agent, went through all the standard steps.
Can I ask a quick question? I'm sorry to interrupt you.
Yeah.
Did he, when you started working with him, did he understand some of the building regulations? Did he know about, you know, septic systems and lot sizes and buildable lots? Or did you have to start from scratch and helping him understand all those things?
He had some familiarity. He'd certainly done his own due diligence. He's never done anything like this himself, per se, but he understood the requirements. And then I was the one obviously working with the planning department locally, and actually worked with them. Shout out to Melton Construction in Boulder. Also had them do a feasibility assessment for me for this lot to make sure that he could build the type of home that he wanted to build there. All of which we've done under contract for this parcel of land. And
so you went to see this land right after it hit the market? Like how long had it been available when you went to see it? Okay.
24 hours, something like that. It was a really nice lot. Beautiful lot.
Just popped up.
You know, you could, it's part of a small HOA that does plowing. So that's not a real concern. We did a little bit of due diligence there, and it seems like they're on top of it. It was within walking distance of the town of Nederland, but not an incorporated Nederland. So it would require its own septic system, but it also had a beautiful view of Eldora Ski Resort. Quite a large parcel of land for the area, 1.98 acres. So a lot of potential in a lot of ways, a lot of potential, beautiful area. We got under contract, and during the contract development period, I was engaging a lot with the listing agent. I asked her if she'd spoken to the seller. She said yes a number of times. And I said, spoken, or simply written communication? She said both. So many phone calls.
Why did you ask that question? Lots of emails.
Just to make sure. I mean, I always like to know something about the seller. Not necessarily. I wasn't thinking that this could be a fraudulent seller. It's helpful to know what they're looking for. Who they are. The more you know about the seller, the better you can craft a competitive offer without overpaying, you know? So it's just sort of along those lines. What else can you tell me about this person? The more you know about the seller, the better. It was along those lines.
It really didn't cross
my mind that the seller would be fraudulent at this point in time. I was just trying to like dig for information, really. And so everything added up. Seller's name, seller lived in the Chicago suburbs. The seller's name added up with the title documents, the email address, and so on. So this seller, quote unquote, lives in the Chicago area, owns this parcel of land that they bought in the 70s or 80s outside of Nederland, contacted, and this is the operative word here, contacted, so actually someone else did, but the listing agent thought that this person who owns the property reached out to them and wanted to list them. And so she went through all the steps. She didn't validate that. This person was who they said they were. What had actually happened was someone, it sounds like they're probably based in somewhere in Southeast Asia, had done some research, scoured the public records, and found this random parcel of land in Colorado that did not have a mortgage on it, and then found this listing agent, reached out to said listing agent, and pretended to be the seller, and they also somehow had the actual seller's actual email address, as in the seller being the actual owner of the land's actual email address. Thus, when we went under contract, title company reached out to the actual owner's email address, but this fraudulent individual had quick access to it. So they were grabbing that email and either deleting it or forwarding it on or whatever before the person who actually had access to their own email address had the opportunity to look at it. Now, thankfully, I'm going to say 5 days into the contract, after we'd submitted our earnest money, and this is why you work with a good title company. It's one of the many lessons here. Land Title, because they have seen such an uptick in fraudulent behaviors, particularly with land, and I guess this is just because you don't have neighbors. There's just more opportunity for this sort of thing in land because there's just fewer people watching
people coming in and out.
There's no house
to walk into.
Yeah.
There's no house to see.
Exactly. So Land Title has seen so much of this that now by practice, every time they have someone, they are just assuming that someone's email could be hacked. So every time someone goes under contract now, they're actually sending a physical letter in addition to reaching out to them. And so they sent a physical letter to this individual in Chicago and it's like, hey, congrats for going under contract. And this person gives this letter. They're like, what? I'm not trying to sell that piece of land I own in Nederland. They reached out to Land Title. And then everything was off. Obviously, my buyer their earnest money was promptly returned to them. But the intention of this fraudster was to take the transaction to close. It was a cash transaction, by the way. So we're talking like 10 to 12 days. Take them to close. And then I think what would have happened is they would have somehow tried to commit wire fraud during that next stage. But spooky stuff. Yeah. Very spooky stuff. And another update on this, by the way, I haven't mentioned this to either of you. So my buyer is still looking around. Obviously, we're being very cautious now. I think we came across another potential fraudster. This is last week. Again, another place. This is like Boulder County. And I was checking in. I hadn't even seen the land. Checked in with the listing agent. And I just said, hey, sorry if I'm annoying you. I've had a bad experience recently with this particular buyer. And there is a lot of fraudulent behavior going on. Have you spoken to your... How many conversations have you had with this seller? Oh, you know, a couple of phone conversations. Okay, have you had a real conversation with them, i.e. on Zoom or in person? No, I haven't. They're a little bit hard to pin down because they have some medical issues. I'm like, okay, just so you know. And I gave him this context. Yeah. And his eyes kind of perked up a little bit. And I asked a couple more questions about the seller. And he said, well, honestly, he's sort of hard to understand because he has a Russian accent. I'm like, wait, hold up. I checked the public record. This guy's name is like John Aronson or something. Very like non-Slavic name. Like, wait, did you say he has a Russian accent? Yeah, really thick Russian accent. Like, hang on. Absolutely no way this guy is from the actual owner of this land is from, should have a Russian accent and a Slavic accent, let's call it. So thankfully I was able to tell this guy, you know, my story. And I was like, I would look into this. And he's like, man, this is weird because the guy was really sketchy about signing a listing agreement with me. He said he would do it all later. He kept just telling me he was going to do it all later because he's having medical issues. And I was like, oh man, I would look into this. If it turns out this is a real seller, like let's get back in touch because the land looks really nice. But I think that someone's trying to take you for a spin here. So there's obviously a lot of this happening.
Yeah.
I've got two questions. Is it okay if I interject with some questions?
Yeah.
First question, what sort of price ranges are we talking about?
$250,000.
Okay. All right. And the second question just spaced my mind. okay. I don't know why. I totally spaced the second question.
I'll say I really feel for these listing agents as well, you know, getting taken on a complete ride.
Yeah. Oh, that's the question. So this agent told you that they were having a hard time getting this seller to sign the listing agreement. But they must have because it's on the MLS. So somehow they signed a listing agreement. You can't list a property that you don't have an executed listing agreement. So
he said this. He said a series of documents, including the listing agreement. So I think that maybe he meant the seller's property disclosure. But he inferred that it had taken a while for him to sign the original listing agreement. And you're right. It must have obviously been signed if it ended up on the MLS.
They'll say like a delay in the SPD makes sense, right? If I was, you know, thinking about vetting a client, that would feel normal, especially if they've got health issues coming up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So if you're an agent listening to this, a real estate agent or broker, I hope you're catching the red flags here. Property, land, no structure on it. So buyers don't have to get permission to access the structure. There's no lockbox. A seller who is doing everything remote has a health issue to explain why they don't want to get on a video call with you. And probably too easy, right, in terms of happy to work with you. I don't know if Russian or Asian should be a flag issue, but if the seller's name is something that is, you know, more, you know, common American name, and the person has an accent that doesn't line up, maybe it just is a contributing factor. Ian, that's like unbelievable. The amount of work that went in by this listing agent, photographing the property, pricing the property, the negotiation, the whole roller coaster of excitement of negotiating with the agent, getting it under contract at hopefully a good price that makes our client, your client, happy. And then to find out it's all been a scam and that your client almost lost $250,000 over
cash too, right? Just
It wasn't the bank losing the money. It was your client losing almost $250,000.
Yeah, so it brings up a series of questions, right? I mean, we only can exercise some – there's a limit to how much control and, more importantly, how much interface we can have with the sellers on the buy side. But we can take further precautionary steps, and I think it's appropriate – moving forward to validate with title at an earlier stage that this person is real, the seller is real. I mean, just sort of taking a step back, anytime we have a listing, and this has already been in place of House Einstein since before I've been here, we always validate the seller, right? And that's a real conversation. That's either face-to-face or at the very least is a Zoom call, because this isn't the first time fraud has occurred. We can, at the very least, now moving to the buy side with land properties, we can, at the very least, ensure that this has taken place with the seller on the listing side. And then I think it's also now prudent and appropriate for us to require, before we go under contract, require some sort of validation from title company. Because it's...
I remember working with you a little bit on this deal, and if I remember right, the seller also didn't put the title company. And I mean, in past experience, I think we've been able to kind of shimmy in our preferred title company being Land Title. And I'm just kind of thinking, you know, what if it wasn't a competent title company? Could you imagine how much further along this scammer could have gotten?
Or is a totally fraudulent title company? What if the title company is a scam? So it has happened, and this is before your tenure, Hamish, but there were a lot of fly-by-night title companies maybe about 10 years ago. And it was way too easy to set up a title company, and still is, frankly. And some of these title companies convince agents to use them, and the agents can't tell the difference, don't understand why you don't want to use a fly-by-night title company. And meanwhile, hundreds of thousands of dollars are wired into an escrow account. And getting that money out if the title company disappears was a serious concern about 10 years ago. So there were transactions where I insisted that we use a reputable title company. And there are other ones besides Land Title. There's Chicago Title. There's Fidelity. There's known title companies. And if it's not a known title company, the question is, why are we using them? And the cost savings is marginal. It's like $50, $100. And so switching to a no-name title company is a huge red flag. And I always look for who the title company is on a listing agreement. But it's great to hear that they've got some safeguards. But at the same time, the sophistication of the fraudsters is moving up. That's pretty impressive to convince. I guess it's easier to convince a listing agent, right? They really want the business. They're excited to have this deal fall out of nowhere. They get to list some land up in Netherland.
And a shiny piece of land at that, right?
And maybe at a really attractive price.
Yeah.
It's pretty smart.
That's where they murky the waters, at least, as well as, you know, have the agent do the comps for the property and everything and price it reasonably. Well, it doesn't... I see a scam on Marketplace, and I know it's a scam because it's absurdly cheap. But in this case, you know, if it's fairly priced and well marketed, it just looks like every other thing.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Any other lessons from this, Ian?
I mean, like, I back to the title company just from when I'm on the buy side on the land deal, particularly with a known cash buyer, I will just require that I interface with the title company in an early stage, ideally before going under contract, just to validate that. It's sort of common practice to when we're listing a property, we work with primarily with Land Title in Boulder. We sort of put together all the work, and usually when we're under contract, we reach out to our title person or say, hey, by the way, we're under contract on the list side. I think in this environment, it's very reasonable to ask the listing agent to reach out to title company before they're under contract with us and me, in this case, on the buy side.
Why not just do it before the earnest money is deposited? That way it doesn't become another hurdle to going under contract. Like, why not just wait until you're signed up and then check title?
I've got a good reason.
Just because I'd hate for my buyer to go through this again, even if it's more anxiety-inducing when there's earnest money that could be forfeited, but it also just sucks to, you know, to attempt to buy a property and then find out it's some scamster in former Soviet Union.
That's a great point. And it is such an emotional roller coaster buying homes. And it's so draining. I can't imagine, like, you saved them, you got them as earnest money back. Your client got their money back.
Yeah.
But they're not going to get their innocence back.
Yeah. And, you know, it's a very reasonable request to make to the listing agent. Look, listen to what just happened to us. And by the way, like, worst case scenario, they find out they're fraudulent. Like, the listing agent wants to know as early as possible too. Like, I felt bad for this other agent on the list side. I mean, mm-hmm. she felt awful, and I had no intention of making her feel any worse. I was like, hey, listen, you know, this sucks for both of us. It sucks for you. You've spent a lot of time on this. Like, I'm really glad we didn't get further along, but, you know, no hard feelings towards you. This is just a bummer.
Yeah.
Well, you've seen the AI. It's not even AI. It's low tech on Zoom calls that will turn you into a rabbit or a cat. How far away are we from technology that will allow you to real time impersonate somebody digitally so that you're on the call, but you look like Brad Pitt and you look convincingly like Brad Pitt or whoever? This, like, they take a photo of the seller. Right, they take a photo of the seller, or the seller has uploaded all this content to social media like we do all the time, right? And is now using the data to create an artificial version of you that they pipe into the Zoom call. I think it's totally feasible. We have a seller, by the way, that is traveling internationally, during which time they'll probably be closing. And I thought they'd need to set up a power of attorney, but the answer is no. They don't. And I'm like, really? How is that possible? And they can do all of that. They can handle all of it. Land Title's doing it. They can handle all of it over digital means. And I was like, okay. I don't like that.
If they have the means, I suppose, yeah. It's hard to broach the topic of fraud and scams without getting too doom and gloom on the internet and kind of have a negative outlook towards things. The more things I'm watching and hearing about, it feels like we're entering kind of a new era of insecurity, I'll almost call it. It's a little bit spooky, we'll say that.
I don't think it's how any of us at House Einstein are wired to be negative and to be constantly suspicious. It's why we're surprised when people behave badly. We're like, how can this person behave unethically? Because we're not wired to behave that way. And I know that of each of us on the team, and Sophie too, who's not here. I'm still surprised when people just lie to my face. I'm like, wow, that guy just lied to my face. And it's because it's just not how I'm, like, I look so uncomfortable if I'm forced to tell a lie. And it's one of the reasons why I will not do negotiations with video calling, because sometimes you have to bend the truth a little bit. I wouldn't call it lying. I would call it advocating.
Negotiating.
It's way easier. It's negotiating. It's way easier to do that over a phone call, and it's even easier to do it over email. And sometimes it's like, tell me your client's highest and best number. And I'm like, well, they're willing to pay this, right? They're willing to pay this number, but I'm not going to tell you my client's highest and best. Or they'll ask me, is $1,000,001 your client's highest and best? And if we're on a video call, my face is going to give it away.
Yeah,
no right? doubt. If they're billionaires, it's like, no, actually, that's not their top at all.
And that actually, I mean, we're kind of chatting, so that segues into the whole proof of funds kind of struggle, right? When you submit an offer and you've got your proof of funds with you, if you're a cash buyer, not a lender letter, even in that case, kind of have to be careful to protect the whole pie, especially when you're negotiating over chips.
You're thinking about our recent sale, downtown condo sale.
Yeah, that one too.
That deal was really, really weird. We always tell our clients, and I won't go into further detail, but we always tell our sellers and buyers that you should show financial information that's required, but not more than that. So if you, again, buying $1 million property and we're offering $950, you want to have a bank letter from your wealth manager, or if you're getting a mortgage from your loan officer that says you are qualified to purchase at this price. You do not want to show a screenshot of your investment account that shows you have 10 times that liquidity in assets you could liquefy 24 hours. That's not helpful when we're trying to save you money on the negotiation. Yeah. So, but it's funny. Some agents don't care. Honestly, they just don't care, and they're not thinking in terms of negotiation strategy.
So, what are you two seeing in the market right now?
I really like to look at the data rather than just talk about how it feels, because how it feels relates to all of our buyers and sellers. And how it feels is we've got several sellers that are prepping their listings. We'll talk about it at the end of the podcast. And the work that goes into prepping those listings, we're trying to guide them by the hand. And on the buy side, we're hearing frustration. We're not finding the homes we really want to buy. Homes are still overpriced. And that sounds like a typical January. any year. It's hard to find a good house. And there's a lot of disappointment that prices didn't fall apart by would-be buyers. But I think overall, my sense is the market's waking up. And I think it's going to be a stronger year than last year. And there might be a window of time where there's more selection than last year, but that window may only last a couple of months if rates drop, and it's a big if. Yeah, what are you seeing? What are you feeling? What are you? Hamish, to you too. Sorry.
Well, I'm just carrying on. There's a big kind of shock, I think, from a lot of relocation buyers when they're coming into the Boulder market. I can really only speak to what I've had my hands in, which is the Boulder Denver metro area. But you kind of get what you get here. And it's from hearing what the other buyers have experienced, where they're coming from, is there is a lot more room for negotiation. And I think this market is strong. I wouldn't call it like a super active or super hot right now or anything of that, but just the general, strength of the market and how much people value a home along the Front Range, there's just generally less opportunity for buyers to have demands on from the onset, you know? So there's just a bit of like a, call it a whiplash or like a culture shock, but in the housing market. Good talk.
Ian? What are you seeing in the market? How are you feeling about it?
I'm having a very busy January, I will say that. I think that people are becoming accustomed to high interest rates. And let's not forget, by the way, not to diminish, let's call it 6.5%. It's a lot more than 3.1%, but just from a historical standpoint, interest rates aren't insanely high right now. They're really not.
That's true.
Yeah, exactly.
And I would, if I were a buyer, I would not be holding my breath waiting for them to drop to 4%. I mean, that would just, you're going to miss out on ever buying property if you do that, possibly. I'm seeing a lot of buyers adjusting to higher interest rates and kind of needing to move on with life, you know, move, buy a place with an extra bedroom due to a increase in family size, something along those lines. I think there's just a lot of people who are through with waiting for interest rates to plummet and are just kind of moving in the direction of just sort of normal housing activity. And I'm also seeing, because it is true that prices did not really drop and interest rates stay high, there's a concentration of demand basically at the kind of entry level price points. For instance, I showed this place in Longmont yesterday, 3-bed, 2-bath, detached 1960s, I think, home. It's on the west side of of Maine to a nice part of Longmont, and it was your classic like place that was just priced low with the intention of getting as many offers as possible. So it was priced at 425, and it was in pretty good shape.
Yeah, that's
like, wow.
Yeah.
Feeding frenzy. That's a feeding frenzy in the goldfish bowl.
Yeah, and I don't normally I don't normally like to see a place on Tuesday. It's not the best time to see a listing because everyone's already been in there, right? And been active for 4 days, but my clients had reached out to me in the morning. Yeah, sure, let's check it out, you know. So I showed up. I hadn't actually interacted with the agent beforehand because my buyers basically just said, "Hey, can you see this place?" And I said, "Yeah, I've got, you know, a book. I've got an opening in 2 hours. Let's go see it." I pulled up, saw the place. I was like, "Okay, I'm going to call the agent right now, figure out how many offers they have. Guess how many offers they have."
Not if they're getting an offer. How many?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Guess how many they had? Tuesday at noon.
Three.
Ten. Three. Ten.
This is on the first day?
No, I mean, they listed on Saturday. They were just kind of collecting the offers and, you know, bouncing them off one another and leveraging them off of one another. So, yeah, a buyer showed up and was like,
"Ten offers.
Hey, before we step inside, just know that they have 10 offers right now, and most of them are going to be expiring in the next couple of hours. So there's no chance to get this place. Sorry, but it can be an educational experience." But it had all the indications of a place that was both underpriced with the intention of collecting as many offers as possible, and B, had enough value that they would, that there would be a bidding war. That's exactly what that is. So that speaks to, I guess, both the fact that there are buyers out there, and I think week over week, we're going to see more and more buyers. And also it speaks to the fact that there is, again, there's this concentration of demand at a lower entry level price points, because as interest rates have risen and property values are still high, people just aren't left with very much cash after close to allocate to fixing places up or to just servicing the monthly mortgage, which is our high.
Well, I would add that it depends on price range, Ian. That would be my counterpoint. I'm not disagreeing with you. I think that under, let's call it 600,000, 700,000, buyers are much more cash constrained. And then up to maybe 2 million, they're still likely to use a mortgage, but they have more cash reserves and more security in their jobs, or probably higher paid jobs. And then above that price point, particularly above 3, but even above 2 to some extent, it's almost certain they're cash buyers and they're moving money from one investment asset to another investment asset. They're liquidating securities, they're cashing in whatever they're cashing in, and they're moving it to a different asset class, real estate, and this is an asset class they can live in. So I was really shocked when I did the analysis above 3 to see that the volume was the same. Initially, I thought it was going to be higher at the end of the year. By the end of the year, in fact, by October, I thought for sure we're going to see the end exceed 2023, exceed 2022. But it basically was the same in the city of Boulder. And negotiated discounts weren't as horrific in the fourth quarter as I thought. They were roughly about 3% or 2.5%, which was the median discount. So those people, the $3 million up people, They're not slowing down, and they're not worried about cash at all. It's they've definitely enjoyed the run up of the stock market, and now watching their personal wealth grow even in cash at 5%.
Yeah.
It's definitely a tale of at least three different types of buyers in terms of their capability.
Absolutely, and I think you might have very lightly lean on this as well, is once you're past that first time home buyer stage in life, you then have equity that you can start wrapping into your next purchases, ultimately kind of making it, I think, a little bit easier to start financing for something larger too. Yeah. Well, we've laughed and cried on this end.
Well, Ian, thank you so much for joining the House Einstein podcast. We're going to keep going with other topics. And the word of warning that you've shared for people that are out there, if it sounds too good to be true, it probably is too good to be true. Seems to be the operative mantra in real estate and probably all things.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
Cool.
Cool. It's been fun. Nice chatting to you both.
You as well.
All right. Thanks for joining us, Ian.
Thank you.
All right. So that was a fraudulent story. That was a story that you probably haven't heard, with a fraudulent seller and a buyer who almost lost their earnest money on a $250,000 deal. They could have lost all of their money because it was a cash transaction, which would have been horrific.
Oh,
I can't even imagine.
Yeah. Spooky on that one. And I'm really glad Tidal was able to catch it. That's insane.
We've had other transactions at House Einstein where we were representing the seller and the buyer's lender got defrauded.
Oh, shoot.
They did not catch it, and they were given fraudulent wiring instructions, and the lender sent the money into the ether to the criminal. And everyone's at the closing table and the wire's not showing up.
Oh, no.
Luckily, it was a big bank, and the next day they wired the money, and the transaction closed, and the bank and the FBI got involved, and I don't know if the money was recovered or not, because that was where the story ended, but $800,000 was wired to somewhere. It's a huge industry, transaction wire fraud in real estate transactions, and it's always better to be really cautious, and in our company, nobody will give you wiring instructions. We will tell you how to get them, which usually involves a phone call from Google to find the number of the title company and talk to the person we know at the title company, or walk into the door at the title company and get the wiring instructions. But you will not get it via email from us.
No.
Ever.
Yep. And whenever we have a client ask about, you know, hey, could I wire? You know, how should I do this? I always write bold, underlined, we will never ask for your wiring instructions. Yeah. Okie dokie.
All right, let's move on.
Yeah.
So, Hamish, tell me something that you didn't know about fire mitigation, our next topic du jour.
Yeah, so this morning, Osman and I met together halfway down Magnolia Road, if you're a local. Magnolia is pretty well known. And it was the National Forest Service and quite a few other organizations, government, and I think mostly just government organizations. They were putting together this presentation on the type of prescribed burns that they do, a pile burn. And just straight off the bat, I didn't know that there were different categories of prescribed burns, and neither did it seem the public that was also there with us. They had a little Q&A, and I think a lot of people were expecting to learn about what I now know as a broadcast burn. That's what you would think of as burning like a whole field or burning an entire section. Whereas a pile burn is you have the Forest Service or kind of the managing body of whatever piece of land it is. They'll come in and cut out a lot of the brush or the dense underwood or dead trees and make a pile and burn it. So we got to learn the whole process there. And this was from the perspective of what the government, local and state and federal, is doing as far as forest management. And then they did tie it into what a homeowner would do, though there's, I think, an individual course for that as well, or presentation.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, it was very interesting to hear them say, so this is the U.S. Forest Service, and it was very interesting to hear them say some things like, there are some houses based on the ladder fuels around them, based on the lack of mitigation, that they're not going to defend. They're going to let burn to the ground. They're not going to put lives at risk to save your house when you didn't bother doing the most basic fire mitigation around it. So this topic, by the way, primarily applies to mountain homes, although we've seen massive and much larger wildfires in town recently.
Unfortunately.
But yeah. It's a huge issue. It's something that is going to increasingly become important in an era of climate change. And we went to learn.
Mm.
And boy, did we learn. I was surprised that they, with, what did you call it, a broadcast burn?
Yeah.
In broadcast burns, in what did you call, very complex wildfire prescribed burns.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, not wildfire.
Yeah.
Complex prescribed burns. They will drop these balls from the air in a helicopter that contain chemicals that when they hit the ground and the ball bursts, they ignite.
Yeah.
They're small little fire bombs, basically, from helicopters they're dropping with these broadcast burns. But with pile burns, it's a little bit It's a little different. And the other thing I was surprised by, so I wasn't surprised that they have to call it in, mm-hmm. you know, that there's permits involved, there's checklists, there's go or no-go decision-making. But I was surprised by the sheer number. Did you catch it? He said like
600,000?
65,000, oh, yeah. Like tens of thousands. I heard 65,000. Right. We did record it. That are waiting to be burned in Colorado. And maybe it's just in our forest. It's not all of Colorado. It's just the Roosevelt and Arapaho forests. That's an astounding number.
I'm trying to think of something to give our listeners, you know, some sort of context. They're like bonfire-sized piles. They're not massive.
But not all of them.
Yeah.
They had a distinction there. Mm. They had hand piles.
That's right.
And they had machine piles.
Yeah.
And the machine piles are huge.
Mm-hmm.
The hand piles look like, I don't know, like they're maybe 6 to 8 feet tall max.
Yeah.
Most of them aren't even that tall.
Yeah. And it was, I wouldn't have thought personally that there was this much bureaucracy, I guess, around kind of forest management. But then hearing some of the public that was there and their concerns, I went to high school here in BVSD. And I guess part of the curriculum is you learn how forest management works and what an overgrown forest is and that prescribed burns and intentional forest management is a thing that has to be done. Some of the Peanut Gallery's comments, it sounded like, one, they were hurt that trees were being burned altogether. And then the other was that they thought that this was just, like, dangerous recklessness, which is maybe we're too close to the matter. So for those listeners that are out of state or not really in forested areas, and this was shared at the presentation, since like the early 1910s, we've been creating resisting fires, essentially. So fire prevention to the max, which has caused an ultra-dense forest, basically, throughout the United States. These ultra-dense forests don't have natural wildfires. They've been prevented. So underbrush and, you know, kindling basically accumulates, and that's how you get these massive fires. Fires have existed in forests naturally for a really long time. There are even some, you know, ecosystems that are centered around fires happening. And so this is kind of our way of getting back to the way things were, which was really neat. And then they talked a little bit about like the trees, this particular site that we were at. I think they called different sites units, but the particular site we were at, you know, they were trying to get more aspen in the area, which just as a fall enjoyer, I'm a fan of. But it was
the color.
Yeah, exactly. Sure. Yeah, it was a wealth of knowledge, and I couldn't begin to tell you how friendly the staff were. I mean, it was insane. It was very casual and just very open. And on your note on the fireballs, I was talking to one of the people there, and she was saying that they're getting around to using drones now instead of helicopters. So they're dropping these little, you know, fall activated fireballs to kind of course correct the broadcast burns as they're happening.
Oh, yeah, to burn in advance. I forgot what that's called.
I just know it as fighting fire with fire.
Yeah, it is fighting fire with fire, but it's when they create another burn to head off the first burn.
Mm-hmm.
They were very friendly and very professional.
Yeah.
And they did it by the book, and also it's nice to know that they're putting this level of resources into managing our forest. And unfortunately, fire suppression that's occurred over the last 200 years is why there's so much built-up fuel.
Yep.
And it's dangerous. And it is one of the things when we go look at mountain property with our clients, we talk about is, okay, there's a lot, like you're in the deep forest here and we're not super high elevation. What's your level of understanding of wildfire risk? And also, not just risk, but the cost to insure just keeps going up. Mm-hmm. And even though this house that I'm in right now while I'm recording is literally in a burn scar and is rebuilt from burning in the 4 Mile fire, we almost lost our insurance over this.
Yeah.
And we now pay way more attention to all of the forest around us. We don't keep piles of firewood next to the house. We got busted for that by the wildfire people who came and evaluated our house. There's all these things that you can do to help prevent your home from burning, but ultimately, there's nothing that's going to stop it if it's truly headed your way. There's no fireproof house, as so many people learned in Superior, even though the house didn't burn, they still had $20,000 worth of mitigation costs because of the smoke that got in the insulation and so forth. Mm-hmm. In the attics are not sealed. So even if you closed all your windows, you still got smoke in the attic. That sort of stuff is a surprise for a lot of people. There's a lot you can do to reduce the chances of your house burning, but there's no 100% chance.
Yeah.
And fire-dependent ecosystems, which I think we're in the urban wildland interface, this is designed or evolved, if you will, for fire. And suppressing it just is unfortunately has consequences that we bear.
Yeah. And, you know, last year we had this listing, 5 in Shady Hollow. It's on our YouTube. It's very cool. Check it out. And one of the things we did when we were reviewing comps for pricing analysis and everything is taking note of the construction materials. A lot of the early mountain homes are kindling, essentially. You know, they're just exposed wood or, you know, sealed and also something extremely flammable. And we've been thinking about fire mitigation for a long time.
Mm-hmm. I look at some of those old 70s houses with dry cedar siding, and I'm like, well, you know, did you think about matchsticks instead? Because you're basically at that level.
Some phosphorus paint.
Wrapping your house.
Yeah.
Right. Phosphorus paint would be great. A great idea. I also, so the other thing I didn't know was that they use regular propane torches, like the kind of torch that you might use to work on a car, for example. They're not walking around with flamethrowers, at least for burning piles. I kind of thought they would be.
I thought
they'd have some sort of accelerant.
Yeah.
There was no accelerant, and those piles went up so fast. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and they were talking before they'd even lit anything, right? They were taking us through the process, and they mentioned that you need to be upwind, essentially, of the fire so you don't get licked by a flame. And I've known fire all my life. I was like, yeah, sure thing. Once they lit these piles, it was like a 15, 20 foot, you know, spire of fire. It was insane. Yeah, they just went up.
They also look at things like snow cover. So they want to see 6 inches across the entire unit, not just in the immediate vicinity. They're also looking at wind. And I thought it was just surface wind, but no, they're looking at transport wind, like wind in the upper atmosphere too. And if what they see on the ground doesn't match what they had on the forecast, they literally are calling the weather service, they said, right? They're calling the NOAA. I don't know who they're calling, but they're calling somebody to check in on the weather and saying, what's going on? Because it's not doing what the forecast said. And they're looking up to 2 weeks and out to see, because they don't want to have a windstorm in 5 days that kicks up a fire that was just, you know, buried and with embers.
Yeah.
And the big machine piles have much higher risk of that than the small little limb piles, the hand piles.
No, it makes sense. There's that level of thought and care to it. But it's always kind of, oh, wow, you know, seeing it and getting kind of a behind the scenes, behind the curtain look. That's neat.
Yep.
Yeah.
It was pretty cool to connect with the staff. I was surprised by the Burning Man connection with the chief.
Yeah.
That he had been the head of Burning Man Fire for 16 years. Like, that was, I was not expecting that at all.
Neat me.
Very nice group of people, and very kind for them to allow us to attend. And not normally, you know, what we think of as what a realtor should be doing, but we really want to advise people to be smart about their purchases. Maybe sometimes smart about time to sell, because fire is a really big deal out here in Colorado.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
All right, shall we move on?
Yeah, that's it.
Let's talk about our sale of the week. 819 6th Street. And I actually have been writing about this house in the January newsletter. So I'm just going to jump into the newsletter rather than do live research as we go through it. Because I know this house. And the take home is the home was designed. The architect of the home was Hobie Wagner. Hobie is on par with Charles Hartling, or close to it, when it comes to famous architects of Boulder. Hmm. and he's designed, I think, over 200 structures, or he did design. He's now deceased. And this is one of the private residences he designed in the mid-century era of architecture. And it truly is a very attractive home. Let me pull up the notes I have in our latest...
unreleased our latest newsletter, too.
Our unreleased newsletter. Oh, yeah. That's a good point. And this is a good moment to remind you that if you want to know what's going on in the market and you want to see our thoughts on a regular basis, we do have this monthly newsletter where we talk about sold listings, but we also talk about active listings in the newsletter. It's called, the newsletter itself is called Fresh Listings. You could find it at the House Einstein website. Go to houseeinstein.com. You can sign up for it. There's no advertising in it. You won't end up on somebody's, I don't know, junk email list. We do our best to put out very high quality content. And it's the only place we'll talk about active listings, although this particular property happens to be a sold listing. So let's start with location. The house at 819 6th Street is exceptional in its location. It's just steps away from Chautauqua. It's a very fast bike ride downtown. I used to live actually not very far from this, a couple of blocks. When I first moved to Boulder, I rented a house on 8th Street. And there were no e-bikes back then. I had some amazing legs after living in that house for a year because riding my bike up and down that hill was pretty intense. And it's a location that has very little crime. The home itself is called the LeBrow residence. Those are the original owners, the one that hired Hobie Wagner. And let's see, it's been updated over the years, new fixtures and finishes, but you still get this expressionism style. And that description, expressionism style, came right from the historic home inventory. And what's really unique about the house is it's got this V-style layout, but also a complicated system of butterfly and shed roofs. The house itself is 4 bedrooms, 6 baths, and about 5,000 square feet. So, all right, what happened with this deal? What happened with this deal is that last March, it was put on the market with, frankly, an eye-watering price. It was listed at $6.4 million, which was just, I mean, I get it. It's a nameplate architect. It's a gorgeous home. Mid-century is hot, and the home had been updated, but 6.4 was just an astoundingly high number, and I didn't even attend the broker open because it just didn't make sense, and I had a hard time getting my head around it. Mm-hmm. And 3 months later, they cut the price to by $550, and they refreshed it in early September, so nothing happened. After they cut the price by $550, it still sat on the market. And by early September, which frankly is too late, the season's totally over, they relisted it. So they took it off and put it back on, same agent, another $550,000 price reduction. And at this point, I don't know why, but the property was refreshed every month, like expired and brought back, or withdrawn and brought back on the MLS. I think it was just to push it out to buyers. I've never seen anybody do that before, yeah. But ultimately it did close just recently this last week, and it sold for 5.3, which is, with the small additional concessions, is more than 1.1 million below the original list price. So, I mean, there's a lot of different ways to think about luxury listings. It has to be incredibly disappointing to the seller to have chosen an agent that listed it so high, and they were confident. Obviously, why else would they choose this agent? Some of it's the market downdraft, right? The market did see a decrease in value somewhat last year, but wishful thinking list prices result in two things: a huge discount ultimately to the sale price, and usually a very long listing period. And that long listing period is very easy to say, long listing period, but within that is the experience of a long listing period for the seller. And it is pure misery. You have strangers tromping through your house. They are often disrespectful. They leave a mess. It's invasive to your privacy to have people you don't know visiting your home. And even if you're not attached anymore, which is rarely the case, by the way, people are usually very attached to their homes. It just feels icky to the vast majority of sellers to have people walking around their house. And now have that go on, not for a 30 or 60 day period, but from March through the end of the year, people were tromping through this house. I mean,
Yeah.
I don't know. It's a tough one. I feel bad for the seller to have to experience that. And the best way to mitigate it is to price it right. And of course, market it well. Professional photography, staging, correct all the defects. We go through that with our listings. Like if there are cosmetic and obvious things you could do to fix, do that before we list. We also strongly encourage pre-inspections so the deal doesn't fall apart on easy to fix things that give a buyer cold feet. There are so many things you can do to increase the probability of a fast sale, a clean sale that's not messy. And it's unfortunate that it took this long to sell the house, but it started with a price that was just mind-blowingly high. Mm-hmm. And there is a strategy, okay, to pricing it high and waiting. And it's one that acknowledges you're going to be on the market. You potentially could be on the market for a long time, but you have a very unique asset that's going to take the particular buyer to come by and value. Mm-hmm. And we had a listing not that uncommon as a story similar to this, where we knew we were way higher than all the comps, but there was also nothing like this house. And we knew that, okay, there's some functional deficits in this house, some challenges to living in a mid-century house with mid-century size closets and 1950s windows.
Yeah.
Like there's some challenges in this design, and you have to be the Venn diagram of affluent enough to afford a $5.5 to $6.5 million home, and also willing to live within its compromises, which when was the last time you went a car from the 1950s? Like the number of compromises in design are off the charts. It's still elegant. It's still beautiful, but it is not exactly like living in a modern house. So that means what? You might end up waiting anyway for the right buyer to come along. So the question becomes, well, what do you do about price? The right answer, I think, is to price it right. And if you have to wait, you have to wait. But price it high and have to wait is kind of painful. There is a strategy around pricing it high and then discounting deeply. And it's sort of the luxury goods mentality. Mm-hmm. Like the Gucci handbag is $3,000, but this month and this month only, or this week, we're going to discount it by $1,500. It's half off. We never do this except that we actually do it every Thanksgiving.
Right.
But we're going to knock it off to half. And you can save $1,500 buying this bag. Well, the bag costs $10 to make.
It's
okay, and the bag, like the branding, might be worth $1,500 to you, but the feeling like you got a huge savings is what sometimes compels people to make that sort of decision. So, price it high, big discount on negotiation is a thing. It just should be a. I don't know if it was. Maybe it was a conscious strategy, but it should be a conscious strategy with the seller. Mm-hmm.
And another strategy I always kick around in my head, and I think it's super similar. Is to kind of price with the expectation that you're going to get low balls. So kind of account for, you know, say you get like a 10 or 20% low ball. So you price it 10 or 20% above what it's actually comps for. And then, you know, in theory, you get the number that you wanted to begin with. But I don't see that in houses too much.
It's more common in cars. Yeah. Where the buyer pool is much, much larger.
With and real estate, brash with low balls.
One, if you want to play the long game, you have to be prepared to play the long game. So if I had a seller that we did our usual pricing analysis, which has two stages, right? We do our initial pricing analysis, and then we do our final pricing analysis right before we go active to price it right to the competition. If they wanted to price, say, 10% above what the market really makes sense to price it at, I would probably still list the house. But I'd also do so with double the length of the listing agreement. Like, because I honestly think we're going to be on the market for a year or 2 years as we wait for the right buyer to value this house. And you have to also be willing to tolerate this house sitting there, and you're going to maintain it during this time
period. And you have the showings going on right and random questions from uninterested parties.
Most people don't want that. Yeah. I saw the same story in the last cycle, 2006-ish to 2009. There were a number of high-end sellers that just did not want to believe that prices had dropped. And they waited. Some of those were 2 and 3 year listing periods. They dropped 20-25% from the original list price. Huge numbers. I mean, this 1.1 is also a huge number as a percentage. Mm-hmm. You know, it was originally 6.4 and they cut off 1.1.
Yeah.
That's still a big drop, but it's not quite 20%, is it? What is it? Let's see. Hold on. 1.1. I gotta do the math really quick with a calculator, Hamish. This is when you get too old. Your brain's like, wait, 1.1 out of 6.4. Okay, it's 17%.
Okay.
So that's a pretty significant drop.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's the house. By the way, I would love to live in this neighborhood again. So if you are thinking about selling your home in this neighborhood, call me. At some point, I have this fantasy about buying that 8th Street house that we used to live in when I first moved to Boulder. It is one of the best. There's so many great neighborhoods, but this is definitely one of the best neighborhoods in Boulder. Access to Chautauqua and the open space and the trails, away from the high density, away from the high crime areas of Boulder, which, I mean, relatively high crime. It's just a magical place to be.
Fantastic.
All right, 819 6th Street. Shall we move on and talk about our listings, Hamish?
Yes, we should. Our upcoming listings, not our current listing.
Our upcoming listings. Because my only current listing is under contract that's active. That just went under contract today. And that's a house in Superior, really a entry-level home and a really nice entry-level home and a really good location for people that were value shopping. Mm-hmm. And it's no surprise it went under contract. The listing agent, by the way, the previous listing agent screwed up on that because it had been previously listed at like 100 over.
Yeah.
Where we listed it, but that, you know, a year ago, but they also listed it with the wrong bedroom count and totally slaughtered their buyer pool by listing it as a two-bedroom house. Mm-hmm. So... oops.
The details to come after close. Knocking on wood here.
Details on the transaction we'll share after closing. Yeah. Let's move on to upcoming listings. And because of the rules that regulate what we could talk about, we can't actually give you the addresses. But I can kind of talk to you about the general characteristics of these homes. And if you happen to be thinking about buying... And these match, whether you're an agent or you are a home buyer individually, you're welcome to reach out. And it's possible that we have something that would work for you. But officially and legally, we're not actually allowed to give you the addresses. We're not officially allowed to market these homes. But we have some great listings coming, and I feel like you should know about them.
Yeah.
We have a large listing coming up in Newlands. It's a large home. And large homes are incredibly rare because of compatible development. That's a regulation that limits home sizes in Boulder. It's one of many regulations in Boulder, but Newlands is ground zero for we don't want big houses on small lots. And so all sorts of regulations were passed in the 2005 to 2010 period that really limited home sizes. And on top of that, historic review for anything that's pre-war, and on and on and on it goes. So the odds of building a home this large and capable of comfortably housing a family are pretty rare. And so we're super excited about that listing. We're helping the seller prepare the home now, and we're going to be going through our usual staging consultation in the next week or so, which is usually a 50-page plus document in PowerPoint, room by room, helping people understand what we think they should do to get their house ready. We also have a townhome in Fraser Meadows that should be live in early March. They're waiting to move into a new house. And that townhome is attached on one wall, but otherwise functions exactly like a house. It's got a two-car garage. It's got plenty of bedrooms. It's got a really nice backyard that's shared with the neighbors, so you don't mow this lawn. And it does have a little bit of traffic noise, but that's the only negative, and it's really only hearable from the driveway.
Yeah, it's that when we were putting together the show notes, you called it a townhome, and I had like a moment of, wait, really? That one wall, that's it. The rest is...
It's a duplex, yeah. I think is probably the right term. It's really a standalone house that's a duplex. Mm-hmm. You get half of the duplex. There are some legal distinctions, by the way, between condos and townhomes. But functionally, this is a house with an attached house next to it. You only get one side, not both. Yeah. And compared to the traffic noise you might hear in almost any major city, this traffic noise is a joke. But it is one of the things that a buyer is definitely going to notice when they walk in the door. But when they're in the house or they're in the backyard, it's not an issue. So
I think you would hear more we're excited about in Martin Acres.
Yeah, you would hear, well, depending on where in Martin Acres. It's not like that front row of Moorhead mm-hmm. that is constant traffic noise. It's not that. Yeah. It's way better than that.
Yeah.
Okay. So next listing. This is a home where we represented the buyer a few years ago, and it's a mid-century ranch-style house with a full basement on a very large lot. Mm. And the home, it's got a little bit of a funky layout, but it's a great house. It's private because of the fencing. That big garage in the back is a huge plus. I'm really sad to see them selling the home, and they're likely to be on market in the next month or two. It's probably a home that the end buyer, because of how affluent this neighborhood is and it's pocketed with lots of high-end homes, likely is somebody that wants to look for a home they could build a second story on. And it's a cool house in a great spot. You can walk right to Sanitas. You can walk right to downtown in minutes. You could stroll over to Newlands. Like, it's a house where you don't need a car to have a very connected lifestyle to all the cool stuff happening in Boulder.
Absolutely.
And
I went over to do the staging consultation for that home, and one of the clients had just left out to go for a walk and I think run to the grocery store and everything all by foot.
Yeah. If you want to be car free, this is a great house. And if you want to potentially build your own custom home with a second story addition, this is also a great house. Or if you just want to live in it as is, it's still a great house. It's just a home built in the 50s. And it's very similar to a lot of the 50s ranch style houses throughout Boulder. Let's talk about the last house. The last house is a two-story home in Meadow Glen. It's got a great layout. Meadow Glen is a neighborhood that is on the east side of town. It is just east of Key Waden, and you are very close to the shopping at Baseline and Foothills. It's a super family-friendly, functional house with the layout that the vast majority of people imagine in their heads as a classic house. All the bedrooms are on the upper level. The living area is on the main. There's plenty of space in the basement for an au pair or a guest room for visitors. It's a grad student living there if you want to offset your rent. It's a really nice house in a really often overlooked neighborhood. Very, very close to bike paths and open space. It's not usually on people's radar. And they are likely to list in early March. So that home, we are also helping the seller prepare their listing. Yeah. So those are my personal upcoming listings, all of which are first quarter deals. And then we have some buyers who are looking for some really unique things. And I want to mention the buyers because I feel like our podcast listening audience is growing. And if you have a home that matches any of these, please, please pick up the phone and call me. It's unlikely I've missed it if it's already on the MLS. But if it's not on the MLS, you're thinking about listing it, give me a call. We can work something out if it's a good fit. And I would really like to help these buyers. So the first ones are clients that I have known. They're close personal friends now. I mean, they started off as clients. They became close personal friends. Now they're clients again. They're looking for a home to buy. And they would like a large rambling ranch, not too large, but not like 2,000 square feet, not the standard, 1,200 square foot ranch in Martin Acres with a 1,200 square foot basement. That's not what they're looking for. They're looking for something probably in Fraser Meadows, although it could be anywhere in Boulder, that's a little larger than that, maybe somewhere around 3,000 square feet, but probably not more than 4,000 square feet. Likely have a two-car garage. And mostly main floor living. Mm. They don't really want a lot of space in the basement, or they don't want a second story. They would consider it if most of the home is on the main. And they're lovely people. That doesn't have to be completely turnkey, but should be mostly turnkey. Maybe it needs some minor updates, but not a major project at this point in where they are.
Not a reno.
They don't want a major project.
No.
Yeah, not a major reno for sure. They just don't have the capacity to manage that, although they have in the past, which is why they know better.
Mm-hmm.
They don't want to rent. They also don't want a cheap flip.
Yeah.
But they value craftsmanship.
We have seen quite a few cheap flips with them as well, unfortunately.
Yeah. If you happen to own a home that you updated 10 years ago and you invested considerable resources into choosing finish quality, into choosing materials and fixtures, they're going to notice. They're not looking for the cheap, put some plastic cabinetry up and LED lights and call it done. They're impressed with woodwork. They're impressed with quality. And they're looking for a home that helps them stay in the community. They're already here. They're not in a rush, but they've got a great property that, well, that's what they're looking for. Yeah. We'll leave it there. Let's talk about our next people.
All right.
So these folks are looking for a home that likely has at least 5 bedrooms, but is not a giant house. And they really like the sense of a rural feel to a home, a sense of being away from the hubbub of living in town. So if you were to draw a circle that is the city of Boulder, well, if you draw a polygon around the city of Boulder that's the dense part of the city, and then drag that line, draw a second donut, or you know, maybe a 2 or 3 miles from that. Mm. So there's an outer belt. The outer belt area is where they're most interested in shopping for a home. Places where they have some views, a little space from the neighbors. So it doesn't have to be a walkable neighborhood. A larger lot they seem to like. And a home that is, again, reasonably updated. It's not a home that hasn't been touched in 30 years. They're not interested in doing a massive renovation. And that's, you know, they're very reasonable, kind people. Mm-hmm. And they're looking for something that just is a downsize in space, but still allows their adult children or soon to be adult children to visit and have a room to sleep in. Yeah.
I think you hit the nail on the head.
Yep. We have 2 relo buyers. They're a little different in their relo needs, although I think they're just a little different in budget. Their functional needs are very similar, and both would really like to be, let's just say they're in the 1 to 3 range to encapsulate both of them, and they're looking for newer homes, absolutely no mold issues, functional layouts, good neighborhoods, the classic south-facing house that's been updated and doesn't need a lot of work, and they're both willing to go. I guess one of them would prefer to be in the city of Boulder, which is really challenging to keep it under 2 for that price range. I think that would make them happy if it was. The others are willing to go a little further east to Lafayette. So we've looked at Indian Peaks. We've talked about Prospect in Longmont. And, you know, I would call it kind of your typical nicer, near luxury, but not quite luxury home buyers. Mm-hmm. Would you agree, Hamish? Yeah. Does that encapsulate it?
Yeah, I think that hits it. Turnkey is really important for them too. Yeah.
Turnkey in a way that turnkey, but not a flip. Mm-hmm. Like they just flippers flip quality is really disappointing after a few years. I've sold flips. I always warn my clients, okay, you're buying a flip. Yeah. It looks really pretty. In 4 or 5 years, all these finishes are going to look horrible.
I mean,
and they're trendy.
Some of them even just look good. Fixing. And then the moment you move in, you can see how bad it is.
Well, I could see it at the showing, and yeah. I pointed out. I'm like, look at the fit and finish on this house. It's horrific. Like, and there's paint splattered around places and that shouldn't be, and there's places that are not finished. And there's, like, workman tools in the garage that are messy, too. It's like, what you're looking at is an incomplete project that they rushed to market.
Yeah.
And you're likely going to find a lot of problems with this house later.
Yeah. My basement was flipped, and it's an interesting place to, painful, to feel. Yeah.
Yeah. It's not lipstick on a pig, Hamish, no. But it's definitely...
Man, you should see these baseboards. There's just, you know, little details that you're like, wow, okay, corners cut.
If you see finished nail heads and they have not put the caulk and painted it so the finished nail heads are missing, that's usually a bad sign. Yeah. A rush, rush, rush. And not finishing the job
right. And it's always, you know, if they skipped a corner there, where do they skip a corner where it's more important?
What can't you see?
Exactly.
That's wrong.
Well, I have a window that got deleted in my basement. There's the window well and the window on the outside of the house. But in the room where it would correspond, there isn't one. So it's kind of a neat little feature.
So it looks like a window and a window well, but when you go inside, it's been drywalled over?
Yep.
That's fun.
Yeah. It's...
Are you going to restore the window?
Oh, I'd love to, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. It's a bathroom window, too. So it even more begs the question, why would you seal over it? So, yeah. We'll dig into that once I'm done dealing with the rest of the things with the house. Right now, it's not causing me any issues, so...
I have never seen this house. You bought it without me seeing it.
I did.
And I really regret that I did not insist on seeing this house.
Yeah, well, I'm in it now. So we have a final set of buyers, lovely people, and I've checked out a bunch of houses with them at the moment, and they're really interested in kind of the Louisville area. They'd like to be 10 minutes, and this is sweet spot. We've gone around a few times and looked at a few different options, but they'd like to be, you know, within about 10 minutes walking distance to downtown, whether that be Louisville or Lafayette, and also about 10 minutes from a park or green space, open space. And they're ideally looking for something a little bit newer, detached, and also mostly main level. Though there's a little bit of, you know, between the two of them, they value different characteristics differently. So they're expecting a little compromise. And one thing that I've seen them waver on a bit has been a split level home, so, or a tri-level. So if there is a particularly compelling system like that, they'd be interested in checking that out too.
What's their price range?
Well, I'd have to double check on that. I believe I have it in notes.
Should be in our CRM.
Yeah.
If nowhere else. They're very patient, and they are also family of past clients. And I will say that we take care of all of our clients, but when we get a referral, mm-hmm. I feel like we have two different sets of people to not disappoint. Like, we have to make sure we perform for these other people that trusted us enough to send their friends and family. And so we definitely are, we care a lot about helping all of our clients succeed, but the ones that come as referral, there's a double layer of pressure that I feel to make sure we achieve their goals. Did you find their price range?
And big time. They're about at 900K.
Okay.
And
900 ballpark.
Yeah, ballpark. And
challenging price point.
I've got further notes. They'd love a home office. Yep. And noise isn't a huge issue either. But, you know, still staying off the main roads. We were looking briefly up in Longmont for a little while. And all the ones that came up that would be really nice contenders were on, like, this main road. So a little bit of a non-starter there. But, yeah.
More bedrooms are good things for all of our buyers.
As it actually, turns out.
Except for maybe one. And it's things like offices and yoga rooms that matter. Mm-hmm. We just saw a couple of brand new listings this week with the Hearth and Stone Luxury Home Tour, which is a broker-only event. I'm on the advisory team for that organization. And one of the homes we saw is a pair of listings that are brand new in Superior. Did you catch the bedroom count on those homes, Hamish?
There were like two, weren't they?
One has seven bedrooms, if you include the carriage.
Okay.
The larger home has seven bedrooms.
Jeez. Yeah, okay. That's So the house on the left that we saw, I thought the upstairs, I mean, I think the upstairs maybe only had three, but I wasn't thinking about carriage house. And then I didn't think about basement either.
Basement bedroom, yeah. The carriage houses. I think one of them had six and the other one had, one definitely had mm-hmm. seven. The other one I think had six.
Wow. But nice, you know, and as it turns out, with, I think, more modern practices, the footprint, the footprint's pretty big, but they still fit these rooms in pretty well.
Yeah, meaning it's a large house on a small, a relatively small lot. The house structure takes up most of the lot, which is not something that most people want, but they just have to deal with because that's how homes are built today. New development is almost always large homes on small lots.
It is.
Because that's how you maximize price, because land is not easily available in Colorado. We're running out of land, buildable land. It's why the older homes, it's shocking how small the house is on how large mm-hmm. of a lot. Today, a 7,500-square-foot lot would support a very large home, but in the 1950s, you put you slap a 1,200-square-foot house on that and called
Heck
it
yeah.
good. Heck, you slapped a 1,000-square-foot house on that and called it good with a crawl space.
Yeah, I mean, I'm 1,000-foot up and 1,000-foot down, so a house with a basement, right? That's it. 70s.
Okay, this has been a little bit longer of a podcast than normal, and I did want to tell you guys about that actual fraudulent story and share that with Ian joining us as a guest. Hopefully we'll have him back. If you liked him, let us know. Give us some feedback. We love feedback, good or bad. We deeply appreciate all the feedback we get personally that people that I'm always surprised that people are listening to the podcast. Mm-hmm. I'm not tracking the numbers on it. It's just a fun project, and it has resulted in really good things already. And I'm Osman with the House Einstein podcast and the House Einstein brokerage. You can find me at houseeinstein.com if you're buying or selling. You know where to find us. Hamish, last thought.
You can find Ian also at houseeinstein.com.
That's right. You can find all of us at houseeinstein.com.
All right.